My name is Craig Van Sant. I teach business management courses at Augustana College, which is how I got out here. Paul and Paul Olson also teaches at Augustana. And what he and I agreed that I would do would lead discussions on a series of topics related to the economy. And that I really shouldn't use the economy, because then you'll think I'm an economist and I don't know anything about it. But business and how it fits in society. And we talked a little bit last night about how different social institutions have had more or less influence over society over the past 500 years. And today, the basis for what I'd like to talk about is an article that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly in 1999. I've got 15 or 20 copies there if anybody's interested. And if you have old eyes, you may not want to even bother. It's a really bad copy and it's hard to make out.
Old eyes, did you say?
Yes, which I have. But I read it like 10 years ago, so I have some clue of what it says. But if any of you are interested in the article, there are several copies there. You're welcome to please take them. That means I don't have to carry them home. I use this in a class that I teach at Augustana called Social Issues in Management. And part of why I use it is that the author, Harvey Cox, who is a theologian, some of you may know more about him than I do, but as many authors will do when they try to make a point, I think Cox overstates his case and makes some statements that people find offensive or objectionable or questionable, whatever you want to call it. And that, to me, is part of the fun of teaching this particular topic, is that some of my students get really offended by the concept that market, that we view the market as a god. And one of the surprising things is that people learn best when they are either surprised or offended, and there is an emotional element in it. And so what I'd like to do, I'm going to open this up for discussion 10 minutes into it or so. For those of you who have just come in, if any of you are interested in the article, we'll be discussing the copies there. What I'd like to do is spend about 10 minutes and briefly summarizing the article, and then open it for your thoughts, discussions about what Cox says. So with that, let me kind of run through this pretty quickly. Cox starts off by saying that he is a theologian. He spent his entire adult life studying theology and was approached by a friend who said, if you want to know what's going on in the real world, which is always interesting to me because we talk to our college students about the real world, like we're living in a fake one. But the idea that he was presented with by this friend was what the real world is invested in now is the market. And if you want to know what's really going on out there, you need to start reading the business pages. And Cox goes on to say that he really approached this with some trepidation because he was afraid he'd have to learn this whole new language, this whole new concept about business. And what he was surprised to find was that as he read the business pages in the Wall Street Journal and Forbes and all of that, is that we talk about the market the same way that theologians talk about religion. And so he, like any good academic, that there was an article in this to be written. So he wrote this article, and he talks about, I mean, the basic theme is how the two religion and, or I'm sorry, God and the market have basically not become the same, but we treat the market as we used to treat God. And the first part that he talks about is the fact that we often don't fully understand the workings of the market. And he says, well, that's no big deal. We don't typically fully understand the workings of God. And he goes on to talk about different authors, about how we have to have faith to believe that God is doing what he should be doing, that his workings are beyond our understanding and all of that. And although Cox doesn't reference it in his article, the thing that that brings to mind automatically for me is Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, where he talks about the invisible hand that guides the market. And if any of you have heard anything about Adam Smith, you've probably heard about the invisible hand. And I'll just make a side comment here. I'm probably one of 8 or 10 people in the world that has read the full text of Wealth of Nations. And it was only because I was required to in my PhD program. But out of about 1,400 pages of text, Adam Smith refers to the invisible hand once, and almost in an offhand fashion. And yet that's what all of us have picked up from him. But anyway, that seems to me to be one of the main points that Cox is making early on. He goes on to then talk about how markets, you know, the fact that we have been interested in business and interested in making money all throughout history, as we talked about last night, he dismisses that as being, you know, that's no big deal, because that's true. We have been interested in making money, but up until about 200 years ago, there were other social institutions and other values that placed lids on our quest for money. And in the past 200 years, for reasons he really doesn't go into, business has kind of broken those shackles and is now the social institution that all of us look to. Okay, so he then goes on to talk about not so much the market as a religion, but parallels between the market as a god. And he says, any conception of God typically has three components: omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence. Okay? And so he then goes through each of those with the market. And I'll just touch on a couple of those. When he talks about omnipotence, he defines it differently than most of us would. I think most of us would say omnipotent means all-powerful. Well, he defines it as the capacity to define what is real, which I guess if you think about it is another way of saying all-powerful. And he then goes on to talk about how the market is able to do that by turning God's creations into commodities. One of the best examples that he uses is about real estate. If you look at many of the Native American views of life, the earth itself is sacred, and no one person can own the earth. In fact, Patty's got a poster up in her office at home. Who's the Indian who says, how can you buy and sell the earth?
Joseph,
I think. TCL.
Thank you.
Okay, I should know that here. but there is a completely different view. And again, bringing in another idea, that was one of the, at least in my reading of economic theory, that was one of the major problems that early economists and early philosophers had to grapple with, was how can we, if we want to develop this capitalist system, how can we justify private ownership of what had been public lands? And John Locke was the one who addressed that most directly. And his formula was, well, if you mix your labor with what had been common property, then it's yours. So if you go out to the commons and till the soil and plant some plants and harvest it and all of that, according to Locke, then that becomes yours. And he had some restraints on it, which we've long since surpassed, like, you know, you can only do that as long as there is enough and as good property left for everybody else. Well, if you drive around lakefront real estate today, you know that's not the case. That's all gone. But there's that connection of omnipotence that he's talking about. I'm not going to do that because I don't understand it. The second thing he talks about is omniscience, all-knowing. And do any of you listen to Wall Street reports, Dow Jones reports regularly? And they tell you, what do they tell you when the market's up? What do they say about why that might be?
Well, think words like confidence and demand and
productivity.
Okay.
Trends. Retail sales.
Okay, but what they end up doing is taking individual perspectives. You know, like we individually might have confidence that the market's going to go up or something. And they then pool that and attribute it to the market.
Right.
The market is confident, or the market is apprehensive, or whatever. And we don't even know where this market exists. One of the things that we are, co-authoring, I are working on is the idea of social entrepreneurship, which, if you've not heard that word, it's basically the idea of starting businesses with a profit motive, but using the profits for social good as opposed to individual wealth creation. And in the third paper in this series that Mukesh and I have been writing, we talked about the concept of the free market. And this again goes back to Adam Smith, but has many other acolytes. And the idea of the free market in its purest form is a totally unconstrained marketplace where individual buyers and sellers have the freedom to negotiate with each other for price and quantity and quality and all of that. And again, that's one of the nuggets that we have pulled out of Adam Smith totally without context. Because if you read Adam Smith in its entirety, he actually is an advocate for government controls in some areas. Because, as he says, there's never a gathering of business people where they're not trying to collude with each other to harm the public. And he recognizes that. But this paper that we're working on, well, it's actually been accepted at this point, but it is challenging that concept of a free market and saying that what we should be looking at is a fair market instead of a free market. The idea being that let me ask first before I offend somebody. Anybody in here an economist? Okay, good. I can say this. Economists have the greatest job in the world because they get to assume whatever they want. They assume away all those things like pollution and, you know, they can say that our only interest is in maximizing our own self-interest. Well, that makes a calculus pretty easy. But as we all know, human behavior is much more difficult to understand than that. So anyway, one of the things that they assume away is the idea of market power. And you can actually read economists who say there is no such thing as market power. Walmart doesn't have power. Okay, try and square that with the real world and it becomes pretty difficult pretty quick. And so anyway, the reason we're talking about these fair markets is that our contention is if you have totally free markets, then you have market power, which allows Walmart to make its own rules. And any of you golfers? Anybody play golf? How would you like to play with somebody who gets to make their own rules as they play?
You
face of it, that seems patently unfair. And so that's one thing that we think needs to be addressed, is going to this fair market. But the omniscience part, kind of took a detour there, I apologize. But what Cox talks about with this omniscience is that the market is all-knowing, that it can anticipate our wants and needs and meet them. And if you've taken economics or business classes, that's the way they talk about it. Business is in business to identify your needs and then fulfill them. That completely ignores what really happens. Any of you own iPods? Okay. Sangeetha, before you were aware of an iPod, did you sit around your house saying, man, I wish I had this little thing that was digital, that played music, that wasn't hard to carry and all that? No. Businesses are in the business of creating needs from us. And so the more that they can come up with new products and new ways for us to spend our money, the better off they are. Again, another aside. I'm chair of our business administration department, and part of my duties in that regard are to sit in on classes to observe our faculty members teaching. It's always interesting to sit in on the marketing class, because I'm pretty convinced that the whole idea of marketing is unethical to begin with. But we have marketing teachers that will stand in front of the class and with a straight face and no second thought say, it is your job as an advertiser to create dissatisfaction in your customers. That is what advertising does. I was perfectly happy when I woke up this morning, but now I found that they've got this really cool new computer that weighs less and does more stuff than I had before. All of a sudden, my old computer doesn't look so attractive, and I need to buy another one. The advertisers have done their job. I want to just make a couple of observations that aren't related to Cox, just as examples. How many of you have bought stuff from Amazon.com? Almost everybody. What happens after you've bought two or three books from Amazon.com?
suggest new ones for you.
And all of a sudden, they know what kind of books you want. And heaven forbid you buy a book for a friend that has totally different tastes than you do, because then they get all screwed up. But this is to me, a prime example of how business is moving towards omniscience. They collect all the data that you put in your computer. They see what you buy. They start targeting advertising directly to you as opposed to a broad range. They can do that data mining with all that information that they collect. Another example of this, if any of you saw the movie Minority Report, probably came out 8 years ago or something, Tom Cruise plays a policeman in the future, and they've come up with a way of predicting crime so they can go prevent crime as opposed to solve it after it happens. But anyway, through a series of misunderstandings, Tom Cruise becomes accused of being a criminal. And there's a scene in this movie where you don't really understand why he's doing it when it happens, but he goes and sees this guy who can surgically remove his eyes and implant somebody else's. It's not a particularly pleasant scene to watch. But soon after he recovers from this surgery and has this different set of eyes, you see why. Because they have interactive advertisements all over the place, and as you walk by, they have these optical scanners that read your eyes and say, oh, this is who you are, here's an advertisement directed for you. Now, we're not doing that yet.
Oh, yes, we are.
Or?
Google Mail. Have you used Google Mail, Gmail?
Well, no, no, I use Yahoo, which means I'm old.
Make a Gmail account, and next time you have an email, the subjects of your email will be reflected in the advertising on the right-hand side.
That's right.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
By the way, they term, you know, the term of art is they want to capture your eyeballs.
Well,
I mean, they mentioned the way that advertise, the way Google gets paid is how many eyeballs it captures.
Okay, so they're actually talking about looking at something as opposed to
that's the term of art.
Okay, so. Oh, you guys, I thought you guys were getting off easy. I lost my second page of notes. Okay, and then the final one that he talks about is omnipresence, that it's present everywhere. And I guess he makes a pretty weak argument here. He doesn't spend a lot of time talking about it. And I think part of that is because it's so self-evident. Name any activity you've done in the last 5 years that hasn't involved business somehow. When you got here on Lady of the Lake, that's a business. You put on your shoes this morning, a business made those. Whatever, okay? We can talk about all that. But the other thing that he talks about is that we start to apply economic calculations to all kinds of events. And I thought, and he says, you know, like, marriage and child rearing and all that kind of stuff, which I used to think was stretching it a little bit. But if you watch the TV shows today, The Bachelor or, you know, Lost or what's the one where they kick people off the island?
Survivor.
Fortunately, I've never seen that one. but Patty and I had a friend back in Roanoke, Virginia, who is an economist, teaches at Hollins University. And he was very fond of, we used to eat Thanksgiving dinner with him every year, and he was very fond of, about 45 minutes into the time we'd been there, somehow steering the conversation with Patty towards every event. Every event is a transaction. We can, through economics, explain anything. Who you marry, how many kids you decide to have. And Patty was quite resistant to that notion. She was convinced that there were things you couldn't do that with. But the market says we can. He then hits a couple of small points at the end, some of which I'll just mention to you. He talks about the fact that the clash between the major religions of the world, which, Peter, you were talking about some last night, or even the clash of civilizations, as Samuel Huntington talked about, that isn't the real issue that we are facing in this world today. He says that the real issue is the clash between the religion of the market and all the other religions, and that is compounded by the fact that the world's religions, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, whatever, don't recognize that the market has become a religion. And I want to start off the discussion with a question related to that. So we'll come back to that. And I guess the only other one that I'll mention before I open it up for discussion is his concluding paragraph. It again is talking about not recognizing the market as a religion. He says there is one contradiction. Well, his argument before this is that the religion of the market has shown that it can pretty much envelop, incorporate, and overwhelm the religions of faith. But he concludes this article with one contradiction that he says is, in his mind, irreconcilable. He says, all of the traditional religions teach that human beings are finite creatures and that there are limits to any earthly enterprise. A Japanese Zen master once said to his disciples as he was dying, "I have learned only one thing in life, how much is enough." He would find no niche in the chapel of the market, for whom the first commandment is, there is never enough. And that will lead into a later discussion about dominion, which I think is tomorrow. But let me ask, as a starting point for discussion, what does it take, and I'm asking this because I don't know, as I mentioned last night, I am no theological expert. What does it take for something to be a religion? Okay. I can believe in hard work. I don't think that makes it a religion, just because I believe in it. Anybody want to attack that? What do we attribute to religions that separate it from other types of social institutions?
Well, Tilly talked about your God being your highest good. And so I would think that your highest good could be work.
Okay? And that's all it takes, is your highest good.
Part of it, anyway.
Okay? Paul?
I wonder if part of it wouldn't be it's the paradigm through which you see everything. I look at what kind of cars I buy. Is it a Prius or is it a Hummer? Responsibility to have two kids and not 40. Everything. And it's contingent upon my sense of religion.
Okay, but in that definition, it could be an individual, as Peter's could be. That individuals could have their own religion unrelated to anybody else's.
Bingo.
Well, no, I'm asking.
Yeah.
Well, I think another part of it is that it guides your life and you constantly refer to it for guidance. So you're kind of going back there and hoping for guidance from this God.
Okay.
And it does seem there are people that definitely use the market as their guide for they're looking at everything through that paradigm.
Sure.
And some of that's unconscious.
You mentioned the comment about the individual. Maybe what makes it more of a religion is in the cultural context of that time, enough people are facing a similar situation, either their how they make a living, what's around them, that the group of individuals comes to have similar values and trust or faith in that higher oneness or that higher being.
Okay. Well, let me push that a little with you. Do you think that's a necessary element of a religion, that it be a common thing across a number of people?
I do, to give it that thumbprint of religion rather than personal belief. It's moving it to a broader level.
Okay.
I like the word faith and religion, but I think religion is where we go to find value, our self-worth. And I think it increases when we realize when we think or feel that others have found their value and self-worth there as well.
Okay. I'm sorry, I don't know names. I dislike pointing, but you, and then Peter.
I think we show a devotion to and create ceremonies for our beliefs and religion.
Okay, so there's a ceremony.
If it is a work, I think we have ceremonies about the way we go to work, rise at the right time, always on time, you have certain tenets that you believe in, and you create even ceremonies around those.
Oh, yeah, and I will also tell you that businesses go to great lengths to create ceremonies within their business so that people feel good about what they do. Yes, ma'am.
So there's a difference between spirituality and religion, right? Religion.
Don't ask me.
Well, within religion, you can evangelize and you can teach other people what
Yeah, I was just reflecting on, I mean, for me, the religion is much broader, and it has things that are written down, and it has rules and guidelines and, you know, scriptures and stories and things that are concrete, and whereas this, people were talking about the spirituality and the faith and the higher power, the greater good, and that can all be individual or, you know, personalized, but the group, the religion part of it is a solid, concrete something that is all agreed upon, that can't be interpreted or changed. Well, I mean, it's interpreted, but it's written down, so, and then discussed, and but the God consciousness is kind of your own understanding. That, so it's different than spirituality. The religion is, you know, passed on and solid.
Well, let me get to you in a second. What I'm hearing so far is we're defining religion as your highest good, something you truly believe in, that is somehow communicated and accepted across a broad range of people.
And institutionalized.
Okay. I'm not sure where that came from. Okay.
Invisible.
Kierkegaard said that ethical behavior, the good or the bad, the next level is religion, which informs and has a systemized value system that informs right and wrong decisions. So it is kind of a step above a agreed upon or authority to which one can appeal to make right and wrong decisions. That, so it's more than personal in that sense.
Okay. So the next question, since we've now defined in explicit detail what religion is. Is the market in our society a religion? Does it qualify based on those things? Is it the highest value? Is it something that we base our decisions on? Is it institutionalized across many areas? Ron?
I think perhaps it's becoming that, because as Christians we turn to Jesus as the messenger of those values, and Muhammad for Muslims, and Buddha for Buddhists, and now we're turning to Donald Trump and others as our guide for those values, and there are more and more people like that. The economists and the great wizards of money, well, we can't wait to hear what they have to say, so we can follow them and make more money and find the values of what we want and what we need.
And with that, I'll get you and then Sandy, but have any of you read, or some of you may own shares in it, but have any of you read about a stockholders meeting with Berkshire Hathaway, with Warren Buffett? You talk about being treated like a god. I mean, people just flock to him as if he's all-knowing. Yes,
well, I definitely think the thesis here that the market is has become reified and made godlike is has a lot of strength in the market. The only part I think that it's sort of overstating the case is that I think in the social and familial sphere of life, which has gotten more and more, you know, constrained or at least limited, you know, in how we raise our kids and how we interact with our spouses and our families, I'm not sure I would buy. I mean, religion does inform that also in a very deep way, and I'm not sure the market has. I can make all kinds of arguments as to how the market has impacted that, but I think there is that zone has not. I read a lot of Philip Dick, who wrote Minority Report, and I've been reading it for many years, and he would contend that eventually it will get there. I don't think we're there yet. So I would say that in that regard, the market is not yet God.
Okay. Sandy,
except I was going to say that I watch families who really encourage their children to go to certain schools because of the wonderful high-paying jobs they will get out of it. And their families that I know what their values are and what they've taught all through the time, but when it comes to deciding what's more important for their children, it will be that they go to the school that will get their child to the most competitive, high-paying job.
Yeah, I think it all comes back to issues of power and powerlessness, because you can reach to religion to find a sense of personal power or power in your group of people that are worshiping in the way you are or what have you. But in this world, this contemporary world, how many people feel powerless because they don't have economic power, which is, you know, this the engine behind so much conflict. And so maybe it really the comparison to of business being a religion needs to include this issue of power when it's compared to religion. Because I think it does, I mean, if you are successful in business, you have a lot of power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me follow that up with what I hope is a disturbing question. If we're looking at lack of power for many people in the economic sphere, which all statistics say that the gap between rich and poor is growing very rapidly in our country, does religion then, religion in terms of faith in a higher being, does that become focused on the economically disadvantaged? Does religion become constrained? Do we say that, you know, all you guys that are making lots of money in the business world probably aren't going to be too worried about religion because you've got power in another sphere? And then shift the focus. Bob?
Well, I think historically religion has always been part and parcel of affirming those who have wealth and power. And then the religion that is defined and perpetrated by those and legitimized by those who have wealth and power, then it's used in a predatorial way on those who are powerless. And in ancient cultures, there was a very few, like in Roman culture, at the top, the poor down at the bottom. And I think that secularized Christianity does that. I think cultural materialism does that today, and I think that's why we're heading into materialism, which is becoming religion, or at least doing the things that historically religion has done. I think the one footnote to that is what makes us Christians, because if we believe Jesus is who, you know, if we believe Jesus is all the fullness of God in human flesh, then through Jesus, religion is redefined and radicalized, and it becomes God comes for the sake of the vulnerable, the poor, and the weak. But that's atypical, I believe, of historical use of religion or historical religion.
Let me ask you a question about a term you used that sounded like an oxymoron to me.
Okay.
Secularized Christianity.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Well, cultural Christianity, where Christianity becomes a means to support a distorted and even perverted economic system.
Okay. There was somebody over here that had a hand up, I thought. No? Okay, Peter?
Well, precisely, not only a dominant system, but supported by the predominant theological system. That's a winning combination. I'm king because God said I'm king. Everybody's comfortable with that for a lot of years,
mm-hmm.
and accepts that as reality. Or you know, and that's so claiming this is the Christian nation, this is the Christian way, endorses any number of heresies when it comes to the true faith. And that's why it's so dangerous, because it legitimizes, God legitimizes what's done in the name of God, is, you know, historically. The verse.
I'm just going to throw in an advertisement now for John Nunes' sessions on Lutheran World Relief that addresses exactly what Peter just talked about with an hour of development and participation. So I'm recruiting.
Yeah, but I said all advertisement is unethical.
I felt very satisfied.
It's like when you have a 54 Chevy, they don't do this so much anymore. When the 55s came out, you had to have one. Mm-hmm. And when the 55 came out, then the models changed a lot, right?
Yep.
This is a different model, you got to buy it.
Okay.
4 o'clock this afternoon.
I should be careful where I'm treading, shouldn't I, Paul, since you're signing my paycheck.
Well, I'm going to plug some things for that, because at 6:15 we're going to be talking about this intersection of popular culture and humanitarian or social justice efforts.
Yeah.
So it follows up with all of what you're talking about.
That's what Bowling prides itself in. I mean, it's one of the guys, one of the people that's organizing the teaching staff. Is a conversation that develops out of one that goes into another. So you're doing it.
Any more? Yes, sir.
Last night you were talking about what's our Christian response.
And I was told by my wife that was the wrong statement to make.
Awesome.
It should have been, what do people of faith, how do they respond to it?
According to my faith tradition, in the words of my leader, perfect love casts out all fear. And so then one of our responses is to refuse to enter into a system of fear. I was on a trip with Habitat for Humanity, and I was talking to a person who does not go to church, and he said, the object of television is to make you afraid and miserable. And I argued with him for 2 days. And I came back from that trip, and I haven't watched TV since. Because I realized, even the news, dramatic crime, murder and violent crime has gone down consistently in the last 4 decades. But the reporting of violent crime has gone up 600%. And it's just this constant message of be afraid, be afraid, be afraid, bye, bye, bye.
I'm curious, what basis did you use to argue against that for 2 days?
Well, I was addicted to TV. I loved it. I was trying to put me to bed at night.
Okay.
I lost.
Well, but I will commend you that you have done something about it. Yeah. I mean, you're probably one of the few people in this room that doesn't watch TV. Okay. I did say one of the few.
Except if you're old.
I was glad to hear him use the word fear, because I think power and fear are very important in the dynamics in all, whether it's economics, government, religion, or whatever you're doing.
And is there a relationship between those two, power and fear?
Mm-hmm. I think there is.
What kind?
There's someone who fears and there's someone who has the power. I think in history over time, mentioned history, fear was one of the greatest controls of the populations.
I think it still is. I think our government uses fear constantly to get the people to be willing to go to war, to create homeland security. All of those kind of things are driven by fear. And constantly keeping the things we should be in fear of in front of us.
Healthcare.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I think years ago, the church used fear with the hellfire and damnation sermons. The power of God and put the fear of God in the people. Fear worked. And now we've gone to a loving God, I think. And I don't know, I feel much better about religion because we're talking about a loving God instead of a God we have to fear all the time.
As we've talked about power and fear and fear works, how do we argue against, and I'm taking it as I've read Cox, that he's making a tongue-in-cheek argument that is trying to get us to see that the market as God is not a good thing. if we accept that premise, how do we fight things that really work? I mean, I used Walmart as an example earlier. You know, there are all kinds of reasons to detest what Walmart does. But the one thing you can't argue about is its business practices. It is probably the most efficient organization that has ever been devised. And it's gotten so large because it is so good at what it does. How do you fight that? How do you resist it? And this is the cool reason to be the teacher. You don't have to have any answers. You just ask questions.
Well, you know, one method, and it's a tough one, is because it does require you to question the whole model within which Walmart operates, but it's efficient based on one set of definitions around efficiency. What it doesn't take into account, you know, is all the what economists call externalities. You know, what Walmart does to local downtowns, and what Walmart does to the, you know, wages of workers in the rest of the community, and as just one set of externalities, and what Walmart does to the business and labor practices of other companies in the communities that they operate at, in terms of, you know, driving benefits and so forth down to the bottom. And so, yeah, it's efficient. What Walmart has contributed to in terms of the gutting of the manufacturing base in the United States, because it's so efficient, because it's buying goods that are manufactured in China, for example. So it is tough, because one of the ways in which the market is an interesting god is that it defines as those higher values a particular version of efficiency, and that's, you know, consumer price, but it doesn't take into account all those other costs that we will pay. You know, we're paying today, but we will be paying for a really long time.
Your point is well taken. Part of what we have to do, I think, is look at the way we define things. I mean, we've got a system set up that has been 250 or 300 years in the making, and we all just go along with it and assume that that's, you know, efficiency is, in business books, efficiency is output divided by input. And so the more people you can fire to have the same output, the more efficient you are. Well, that ignores lots of things about people not being able to buy food for their kids and all that. You had a hand up and then said anything.
Talking about Walmart, Walmart is not the problem. We are. Oh, I want American business. That's what I want, is American business. But I'm going to buy my shirt at Walmart because it's a couple of dollars cheaper.
Yep.
But I don't like this blaming of Walmart for what's happening. Because it's not Walmart, it's us.
An excellent point. Walmart operates within the system that we collectively have established.
Support.
Yeah.
Right. It's a question of how much action we're willing to take to make sure that any justice initiatives we take on personally, or individually, or as a group, always have the face of human beings on it, because otherwise we're just looking at the system in a vacuum, right? You have to see the personalization that's connected to it in order to do anything about it. You have to see yourself and the people that are affected by their policies and all of those kinds of things. But I think our culture, so it goes beyond just the market and the system. It's our entire culture that's so focused on individualism that us making these choices sometimes.
We need to speak to that personalization, because so much of what industry does is depersonalize, and you lose the face of the enemy.
I think if we're going to complain about Walmart, let's make this nation a better Christian nation by all stop going to church.
Okay, you're going to have to explain that.
Stop going to Walmart.
We complain about Walmart, but we all go there.
Right.
No, so let's stop going to church to make this a Christian nation. It's the same
If you can solve the problem, if you think you can solve the problem by stop going to Walmart, we have problems in the church, and the parallel would be you can stop, solve the problem in the church by stop going to church.
Okay. Paul, I think you had a hand up and then over here.
I was just going to ask everyone, I love what Sangeetha said, and think about the BP mess that is so catastrophic we don't even have a clue yet what's going to happen. And it comes right out of what you just addressed. So it ain't just Walmart. And we, somebody said it a long time ago, right? We've met the enemy.
And it is us.
It's us.
Pogo actually said that.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Have you seen the movie The Corporation?
Yes.
I just loved the way that they were talking about corporations and how they were given human rights by the Supreme Court. And so then they take a personality test and they find out that these corporations act like psychopaths. I mean, and every single step. And that finally, they are great people. The people who are the CEOs of these corporations are awesome people. They go to church, they're wonderful, they're ethical. It's just that they're a part of these corporations that make totally unethical, unsustainable decisions. But the most powerful part of that movie was the one guy who got it. You know, it's like, I've talked to a lot of people and they just say religion is terrible. And I say, no, bad religion is bad. The answer isn't no religion, it's good religion. And I think the answer, corporations, is not no corporations, but reform corporations.
Yes, sir.
Just responding to your question, what can we do about Walmart? I think as a faith community, we can educate ourselves on the practices that go on there. And there's a great book called Nickel and Dime that talks about what happens there. And then as far as communities, action can be taken on the local level. The first successful challenge to Walmart building a store was just outside of East Aurora, New York. You want to look. Check that out on the computer. And then local zoning, if you check that out in your local communities, the community I belong to, we have a big box store ban, and any building over a certain size, they basically tax it so much that it can't be built. So.
Wow. Yes?
I have a question that goes back probably half an hour or so, but so you sat and watched one of your marketing professors talk about that your job as an advertiser is to create dissatisfaction. Did you then, as a business ethics expert, get to talk to that professor? And you know, how can those words come out of their mouth in an ethical? You know, what have you ever? Do you ever get to have conversations with them, Jeff?
Oh yeah, we have conversations. You probably heard the term academic freedom, which I would say is really a big part of what Augustana College, where I teach and where Paul and Sangeetha teach, that's a really big part of it. And I would also say, I'm not Lutheran, but having worked at Augustana for 10 years, I've come to really appreciate what I understand to be the Lutheran view of education, which is it should be one of open questioning, bringing, you know, all disciplines to bear on a topic. And I have a personal uneasiness with saying to somebody what you're doing is unethical. I feel like I can make that judgment for myself that, you know, what you're doing is unethical, but I tend to draw the line at saying you can't do that.
Can I piggyback on that, Chris?
Sure.
I think I've been asked this question too before, like, I wonder how you teach at a Christian school, like what is a Christian school teaching? And I responded with, well, we teach the students how to think critically about these particular situations so they can decide for themselves, like Craig is deciding for himself, that statement is unethical and they don't want to be a business person like that, versus telling them what to think, mm-hmm. right? We provide the context.
Yeah, I just wondered where
It hasn't.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had the conversation, and rather than be doctrinaire, I tend to joke with people. And so, you know, I'm saying, wow, how do you live with being unethical all the time? And this particular person apparently didn't have any problems.
I just have, this fits everything we're discussing. Was that person advocating or just saying this is what is? Your job as an advertiser is to, that's true.
And it works.
And it works. But is she advocating it? I mean, I don't even know, but that seems to me to be a great spinoff for conversation.
Yeah.
You didn't have to answer whether she was or not. I don't care. But.
No, you bring up a really good point, and this may be minutia, and I apologize if it is, but teaching business at a liberal arts school is a difficult proposition to start with. Putting it very crassly, and this is an overstatement, the liberal arts wants you to learn just for the sake of learning without any view to how it's going to be applied. And I know a lot of you would argue with that. And business, on the other hand, has the reputation of, we're only going to teach you how to do things so that you can go make money. Well, my view of teaching business is that it has to be a combination. We have an obligation to our students to deliver the content that employers expect them to have. I mean, if you're going to hire an accountant from Augustana, they better know debits and credits and how to balance a balance sheet and all that. But I would say the beauty of being in a liberal arts institution is that we have the freedom, and more than the freedom, the obligation to get our students to think about why they're doing it and whether what they're doing is right or wrong, which goes to the critical thinking part. Yes, sir.
I want to throw one other comment here. It's taking off of the comment the gentleman said we need to reform corporations. I think we're missing something. I think this article misses something, frankly, when it says that, you know, looking at is the market God. I think fundamentally the market is just a byproduct of a more basic function, which is capital. And I think a better question is capital become our new God, or has it been there for a long time? Because the market is for the most, I mean, and we've had this amazing experience in the last 2 or 3 years to really see, you know, what kind of lengths capital will go to self-perpetuate, and the kind of values that, you know, end up getting to happen. I'll give you a little story. I'm a businessman, and I started a business a year ago, and I looked for investors, capital, and the story I got in terms of my particular business was, we're willing to invest $50 million into your business because we think that, you know, it really doesn't work for us to invest less than that because it's, you know, there's not enough return and for the headache that it is to do that. And my model was one where I didn't need $50 million, I only needed $5 million to do what I thought was, you know, fulfilling a particular niche in the market. But capital was not interested in that particular niche. And I think it's sort of my own little small story about how if we ignore or pretend that it's this market that we're interacting with and not the rules that come from a model where return on capital, return on equity is really, that is the religion. Everything comes back to that at this point. Then we're missing something. And it's not like there, and I get to this gentleman here, we can say, well, it's those evil Goldman Sachs people and those evil Morgan Stanley people and those evil Merrill Lynch. And there are probably people there who are pretty unethical and so forth. But the fact of the matter is we've all pretty much accepted as the given that the rules of capital are the rules that we're going to live by. And until we take a look at it and are willing to regulate and or modify and or adjust that, I think it's fantasy. I don't think we're not doing much.
Okay. sums up the discussion about as well as I could. I really think
I'll pay you for that later.
We should pay you.
No, I think you all have hit on what the real topic is. That even as we talk about the systems that we have in place, it all comes back to us. Because we're the ones that have designed the system that allow it to exist, and until we're willing to make changes in the system, whether it be the economic system, the system of raising capital, whatever, things are going to go pretty much the way they are. And that's going to be a long, hard fight. So on that cheery note, yes, sir.
I want to relate one thing my son-in-law told me a couple of weeks ago. He's a real businessman. He's in his mid-30s, but he'll go in after 6 months and say, I need a raise or I'm out of here. I mean, money is really important to him. But he said, we started talking about religion at work the other day. I think I'm the only one that goes to church. I said, okay, I'm not going to discuss the Bible, whether it's true or false, or whether the virgin birth is true, or anything about God. He said, but I think taking my children to church gives them a better moral value.
Any other comments? Thank you all for coming.